Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I think there's three things. Horrendously bad second quarter defensively where we didn't put anything into the game. Getting out rebounded again. It's become a habit of ours. If you look, only two guys rebounded. Two starting forwards get four between them in, 55 minutes. That isn't going to be good enough. You know, our inability to convert in the paint. We got two more shots in the paint than they did, and they scored 14 more points in the paint than we did. To shoot under 40% in the paint is pretty difficult. I thought we did a pretty good job on James Harden, other than the fouls, and it's just really tough not to foul him. I mean, the stuff they give him and call is just, I guess that's the way they're going to continue to call it, but it's hard.
It's tough. I mean, that's four or five in a row. We got to find within ourselves to pick it up and get wins. What got us the lead was we were moving the ball, being ourselves, and then the ball just stopped moving.
It's finally happening. What's been a topic of conversation for so long now and what's been rumored for so many years, become officially a done deal. Pistons owner Tom Gores and the Illich family will announce the Pistons' move back to Detroit. The Pistons are going to move into Little Caesars Arena with the Red Wings. This move has been in the works since Tom Gores bought the Pistons from the Davison family. He hired former sports agent Arne Tellem to boost the team's profile within the city and also, very openly, to lead the team's move downtown.
Unique in that it's at the highest level in terms of competition on the field. We've got a hot hand in that regard. It's a great opportunity and a tremendous challenge. It's a large task. It's a tremendous challenge. They're great. They're a great, great football team. Great coaching. Any big game, any championship game, also any road game, like a pack of defense. Our guys will be up for the challenge. Look forward to a great week of preparation, getting ready to play this game.
Oh, I go back, I'm 52, so probably 40-some years that I grew up in northeastern Ohio, and my family were big Woody Hayes fans and Ohio State fans, and for some reason, to this day, I still don't know, but I do remember it. My mom said, hey, you have to go run an errand, and I threw a fit, and I was 6 years old or something, and so sure enough, we go run an errand, and it was colder than cold, and we went to some outdoor mall in Ashtabula, Ohio, and I remember I was so upset that I had to leave the TV, and over the loudspeakers outside at the mall, I would stand and listen to the game while she was shopping and doing whatever she had to do.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed. It is 10 minutes after 3, and you know what that means. It is time for the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. What's going on? Good Tuesday to you. Thanks for being a part of what we are about to do today. Over the course of the next couple hours, we've got a lot of different topics to get into. And a lot of different sports as well. Coming up in about an hour, in fact, about exactly an hour, about 4:10, we're going to talk with Sean Corp. He's all over the Pistons move, or the announced move today from the Palace at Auburn Hills to the Little Caesars Arena. They're going to share downtown Detroit with the Red Wings. We're going to find out what that means for the Pistons and Pistons fans. We'll talk to Sean about that. In fact, in the first hour, which is guest-free, we can talk with you about that and find out how you feel about it. Does it matter to you a whole heck of a lot? Everybody loves a new arena. Everybody loves a new building. When it's new, the novelty of it is very, very cool. I know I was in Cleveland, of course, way back when the Gateway Project was conceived and was eventually implemented, and the new buildings, which then were called the Gund or Gund Arena and the Jake or Jacobs Field, which are now, of course, Quicken Loans Arena and Progressive Field. It was a huge thing. It was a huge thing for a while. Obviously, the Indians, when they opened up their part of that whole thing, Jacobs Field, they happened to have the best team in baseball, or one of the very best teams in baseball. They just went on a magical run of division championships, playoff appearances, World Series appearances, and it coincided with a new ballpark that led to 444 consecutive sellouts, which is just ridiculous and unheard of, really, ever. And So there's a new novelty, but then again, the team has to be playing really, really well for it to mean a whole heck of a lot. Not too many people go down to a building just to admire the architecture. Those people are going to go into a new arena at Little Caesars Arena on Pistons night as opposed to Red Wings night if the Pistons are playing great basketball. And that is going to be the ultimate deciding factor. As far as the boost economically to the city of Detroit, certainly cannot hurt. I don't know exactly what the numbers are. I know that press conference was started at about 2:30 or so, did it not, Jim Cushlin?
Yeah, it's I think it's still going on right now, the ends of it. Yeah. I believe so.
So I don't know what some of the projections are in terms of the economic boost for Detroit and the advantage of being downtown. But obviously it is very, very cool to not have to drive out into a suburban area to go to the basketball game. I know it revitalized downtown Cleveland when those two buildings went up, and then obviously a little bit later on in 99 when they ended up building what is now First Energy Field and then was Cleveland Browns Stadium.
A.K.A. the Factory of Sadness.
A.K.A. the Factory of Sadness. I'm glad you brought that up. That's exactly what it is. But it really did. It revitalized downtown, so will it have the same kind of impact or effect for the city of Detroit? We'll kind of let you decide that if you are indeed crossing the state line and heading up to games already. If you're going all the way to the Palace, maybe you like the idea of going downtown better. Maybe not, but we'll see.
And, of course, the side note with all that is when you think of the Pistons and their home arenas really going back to the beginning of the Isaiah Thomas days in the early 80s. Remember, this was a team that sort of one point long ago shared the old Joe, but then they were in the Silver Dome and then they were in the Palace. So they really haven't had that smaller middle of the downtown kind of arena really forever, essentially. And that's always been an interesting dynamic to me in a twisted way of where the Pistons have called their home for really the last almost 40 years.
Yeah, you know, and there's a lot of memories, obviously, in that building, you know, championships and, you know, you can't think of the Palace without thinking of the Malice.
or the Bad Boys, for that matter.
Well, exactly, yeah. There's a lot of memories there, no doubt about that. Well, you know, if you want to share some of that, you know, how do you feel about that? If you are indeed a Pistons fan living in Northwest Ohio, if you are listening to us across the line, too, in Southeast Michigan, we'd like your thoughts on that. Sean Corp, as I mentioned, will join us from DetroitBadBoys.com. Speaking of Bad Boys, Jim, he'll join us at 4:05, 4:10, roughly. Then at 4:35, we're going to get a little preview of the game. We're going to do a little bit of previewing of the rivalry of all rivalries in college football, Michigan and Ohio State, or Ohio State and Michigan, depending on your perspective. At the Horseshoe on Saturday, number 2 versus number 3, expected to be in the CFP rankings when they come out once again tonight, college football playoff rankings, when they have their next show and their release. It's going to be huge. It's going to be a monumental event. Obviously, it is going to be for supremacy in the Big Ten. Michigan can take a step toward a Big Ten title. Ohio State pretty much can't because Penn State is not going to lose their last game. So it's really just a matter of, this game is going to be determining the potential spot in the playoffs, which, of course, is much, much bigger than a Big Ten Conference or a Big Ten Eastern Division of the conference championship anyway. So we're going to talk, we're going to try to have a preview of that each and every day. Today we're going to talk, coming up with Luke Zimmerman of LandGrantHolyLand.com, an Ohio State site. Tomorrow we're going to talk with Paul Keels, the voice of the Buckeyes, as well as a Michigan media correspondent. And then we're going to do the same thing on Friday. Obviously Thursday will be off as far as a live show because we'll have all kinds of NFL football for you, a triple header on Thanksgiving Day. And those are some pretty good matchups, too, by the way. Very, very interesting matchups. Dallas, Detroit and Minnesota, obviously. Then Dallas and the Redskins, a real traditional Thanksgiving rivalry. Cowboys and Indians, there you go. And then the nightcap is the Steelers and the Indianapolis Colts, who will probably be without Andrew Luck. But we'll have all of those games for you on Thursday.
Bob, real quick on those Thursday games, because I'm pretty sure we haven't been able to say this legitimately in a long, long time.
What's that?
I dare say the Lions game is the most important of the three. Seriously. You just mentioned Luck may not be there for Indianapolis, and despite their win over the Browns, Pittsburgh has still been kind of struggling.
But they're in first place, and they're tied for first place, at crappy as it sounds.
Right.
They're 5-5, so you know every one of their games and Baltimore's games is actually very important, but continue to make your point.
That's very true. That's a status of the AFC North at this point. Mm-hmm. Washington's just kind of okay, but Dallas, as we know, is running away. Meanwhile, that Lions-Vikings game, that's for supremacy, at least for the time being, in the NFC North. The winner of that game is in first place.
The Redskins are more than just okay. The Redskins are 6-1-1 in their last eight games.
Still don't understand how they're doing that.
Well, I'll tell you, they're doing it with some tremendous play. I mean, Kirk Cousins is really, really waking some people. I got to tell you, I was kind of down on him. I looked at some of his stats last year and thought they were a little bit artificial, even though they ended up winning the division. I think a lot of them were very artificial. He did all of his damage against really, really bad defenses and bad teams. And in games where he played against good teams, playoff caliber teams, or plus 500 teams, he was garbage. And so I wasn't a real big believer coming in Kirk Cousins or the Redskins. But they started out 0-2, and I felt really, really good about my belief there. But in the last eight games, they are 6-1-1, and they are in a dogfight with the 7-3 Giants. So they're 6-3-1. The Giants are 7-3 for second place in the division behind the 9-1 Cowboys and for a wild card spot. So they're more than just okay. I think that game is huge. Now, is it bigger than the Lions and the Vikings game? Well, obviously not, because they are, like we just talked about with Pittsburgh, they're tied for the top of their division. What makes the Lions game bigger than the Pittsburgh-Indianapolis game is the fact that, Pittsburgh and Indianapolis are in different divisions, but they are equally as important to those games, or to those teams, because the Colts are one full game behind the Texans in the South, and they need a win in a bad way to go to 6-5. And the Steelers, as I mentioned, are 5-5, tied with the Ravens. So that's a first-place battle there for the Steelers' sake. I just mentioned, in other words, the NFL did a great job this year. Not that they did it on purpose, because you don't know what the standings are going to be when they put the season schedule out. But they have three very, very relevant standings, impactful games on Thursday. And you might be right. Maybe the Lions game is just as important, or more important, I don't know, than the other games, but it's of huge importance because it's a battle for first, two tied teams in the NFC North.
Actually, I'll even amend what I just said, because you bring up some really good points. It's been a long time since all the games on Thanksgiving Day have been blatantly relevant. And that's mostly been because the Lions usually haven't been relevant. So the fact that they
it is,
that's a great point. All three games are absolutely worth it this time.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, if Indianapolis wins, they move to 6-5 and essentially are a half game in front of the Texans, who are 6-4 right now after last night's loss, which we will talk about, by the way, to the Raiders in Mexico City. Steelers win. If they win, they're 6-5 and a half game up over Baltimore. Of course, if they lose, a half game back. I mentioned Washington and Dallas. Dallas is on a ridiculous winning streak, obviously, 9 in a row since losing their season opener. But they still only have a two-game edge over New York. This is by no stretch of the imagination over in the NFC East. And they have a 1.5-game lead, essentially, over the Redskins, who are 6-3-1. So, no, I'm sorry, 2.5, I guess that would be. So if the Redskins win, they go to 7-3-1. The Dallas drops to 9-2, and suddenly that's a much, much closer race for the Eastern Conference, or excuse me, Eastern Division race, let alone for the wild card in the NFC. And as we pointed out, Detroit and Minnesota, very, very obviously relevant as they're fighting for first place in a very weakened division, as Green Bay has kind of fallen apart. You look at these, Jim, and I see, and I talked about this about 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, as we were just kind of entering the second quarter of the season. I look up and down the NFL standings, and with the exception of just a couple of teams or a few teams, this is just parity all over the place. This is just parity. I mean, you look in the AFC, there's the 8-2 Patriots and the 8-2 Raiders. You have 7-3 Kansas City, 7-3 Denver, and then nobody else above 6-4. And then a bunch of 5-5s, including division leaders at 6-4 and 5-5. In the NFC, you have the 9-1 Cowboys, 7-2 Seahawks, and then a whole bunch of, mediocre football teams. The Lions and the Vikings, just a game over 500 on top of their division at 6-4. The Falcons, just a game over 500, followed by the Buccaneers, who are bad at 5-5. Second place in the West, Arizona, was a lot of teams' Super Bowl pick. They're 4-5-1. So there's just a whole lot of real mediocre football teams right now in the National Football League going into, week 13? This is going into week 13, correct?
No, week 12. The Browns week 12. Haven't had their bye yet.
That's right. Thank you. I always forget about byes for which teams have their bye. But anyway, so it's week 12. So you're talking about, you know, a lot of really bad football teams. And as people continue to complain, not complain, people continue to wonder why people aren't watching and why the ratings are going down. And there's all kinds of theories, from the people angry over the protests that Colin Kaepernick started to people who just feel like the officials have become way too much of a part of the game. And last night in Mexico City, it happened again. And we will talk about that, to a lack of great quarterback play, to just, quite frankly, a lack of real quality, outstanding play. It's just you're throwing a whole bunch of really average teams against one another in most games. Hell, even Thursday, which we just got done praising as being three relevant games, the relevant games are not because 9-1 is playing 8-2. The relevant games are because 5-5 is playing 5-4, and 6-4 is playing 6-4, and on down the line we go. It's you know, and then obviously we do have the Cowboys at 9-1 playing 6-3-1 Washington, but it's just a whole lot of mediocrity, and I don't know how people are really excited about mediocrity. They want to see greatness.
Yeah.
And if somebody isn't great, then they're terrible, like the Browns, rather than all these teams that are just kind of, we're hanging around. We're still in the mix. We're not very good, but we still haven't been eliminated, and that's kind of boring.
Yeah, and that's the other side of the coin, too. When you talk about parity, it's not just how few teams are in that Cowboys or Patriots or even Raiders 9-1, 8-2 position. I was just scanning the divisions. I'm about to list every team in the NFL that's 3-7 or worse, and it's not going to be many. Jets are 3-7. Jaguars are 2-8. Browns, of course, Bob, we know, are 0-11. Then you have Bears at 2-8 and Niners at 1-9. So you have those teams at the very bottom. Then you have those couple Raider, Cowboy, Patriot teams in the top, and everyone else feels like they're 5-5 or 6-4, basically. That's what parity means. There's not many great teams, and there's not a whole bunch of truly
awful
teams.
Just a whole bunch of teams that are still kind of hanging around and saying, maybe us, maybe us. Speaking of that, though, one of the teams that really took some steps forward yesterday into being considered one of the elite teams, at least for this year, the Raiders took the measure of the Houston Texans in Monday Night Football in Mexico City. But they did not do that without controversy. Nothing to do with them, of course. It is everything to do with, once again, the officiating in the National Football League. Several questionable calls, and that's being generous to say they're questionable. Some of them just flat-out blatant horrible calls went against the Texans and went the Raiders' way, not the least of which was a 60-plus yard touchdown to DeAndre Hopkins that ended up being called back to a 24-yard gain because the officials blew the play dead, thinking that Hopkins had stepped out of bounds going down the sideline. And once the officials blow the play dead, it is dead. And there is no way to review that. It's not reviewable. There's no way to challenge that. The play is just dead because as soon as a player hears a whistle, they stop going full speed. And then anything that happens after that is irrelevant. You can't count it because people stopped. So what does that mean? Well, it means a couple of things. Number one, it means the league really seriously needs to look at its own officiating protocol. Maybe is the best way to say that. I don't want to just say look at the officials, but they need to start looking at just the protocol that they have set up about how they instruct officials to call close plays. And the feeling now after the, did you see the DeAndre Hopkins play we're talking about, Jim?
Mm-hmm. I got thoughts on that, but continue.
The reason they're, what they're talking about now with the DeAndre Hopkins play, now it is not 100,000% certain that he did stay inbounds, but it is by no means a given or certainty that he stepped out of bounds. And this is the problem, or one of the many new problems that the NFL is dealing with when it comes to officiating. Because the official blew the play dead, meaning everybody stops, they can't review and then say, oh, well, look at that. He stayed in bounds. So now let's just pretend he was still going down the sideline. Would anybody have caught him? Probably not. So we'll call it a touchdown. They can't do that. So what they are talking about now is potentially instructing officials to not blow the whistle if they think that a play is dead, if they think that somebody is out of bounds, if they think that a knee hit the ground. Swallow the whistle. Let the play continue until its normal and natural end. Let it play out until it comes to a stop on its own merits, not because of your whistle. Then blow the whistle, then say, okay, the result of the play here would be a touchdown. I'm not sure if he hit that sideline or not on his way by. We're going to look at the tape. Now it does become reviewable because the play found its own natural organic end and it wasn't ended prematurely by a whistle-happy official. That is something that I think they absolutely need to do because Houston got screwed last night in a big way. DeAndre Hopkins should have been given a touchdown. He wasn't. It's a 24-yard gain. It's a big, big impact on the game and the momentum and everything else that goes along with it. So the NFL is going to have to change the way. It's not just that they have to find new ways to use technology and replay. They have to just change the way that officials are taught to officiate. Officiating protocol, officiating, I'm trying to think of another word and I can't find it, but their procedures maybe is the best way to do that. Instead of erring on the side of, hey, stop the play, err on the side of let the play continue to its finality. Then we'll go back and take a look and see if it should have been stopped earlier. And if so, hey, it's very easy. There's the camera angle. There's the yard line. Let's put the ball there and say, see there, he stepped out of bounds. That's the way I think really it needs to happen. Christian, go ahead.
And I agree with you. That is the way it should happen. And my main thought on this is after I eventually saw this play, honestly, goodness, Bob, my first thought was I saw this exact same thing a week ago, last Wednesday, in the fog, and the Mac crew did the right thing. They let the play continue. It was a very similar play where the question is, did that guy have his foot out of bounds? This was a rocket in this case, and this was the fog bowl that we had here at the Glass Bowl last week, right? And they let the play continue because the official on site right there with the fog assisting couldn't tell if he fully stepped out of bounds. Play continued. Then they went to the review, and partly because of the fog, the evidence wasn't conclusive evidence. So what I'm trying to say is they let the play go forward, fog or not. The Mac crew got this right last Wednesday, and the NFL crew screws it up yesterday. Unreal.
What I want to know, though, about that, Jim, is did the Mac crew get it right because they knew that it was smarter to let it go? Or if there had not been fog involved, if they just weren't sure if there was somebody that stepped out of bounds or not, they would have blown the play dead right then and there. If they're not sure, they blow it. But because the fog made it impossible to see, they didn't blow their whistle because they couldn't blow their whistle because they just couldn't tell what they were looking
at. Well, I'll be the first to tell
you. I wonder which it
is. Yeah, I'll be the first to tell you that there was probably the fog assisting in the whistle not blowing. But zooming out, all I feel is ever since I saw this play last night was, so you're telling me the Mac crew gets this situation right, but the NFL crew can't. Unreal.
Yeah, and again, though, I don't know if that means they're better trained or if it probably more likely means what I'm saying right now, you know, that they just couldn't see it, so they didn't blow the whistle because they just didn't know if they could blow the whistle because they couldn't tell where the heck the sideline was because of that thick fog. Now, having said all that about that play, Dean Blandino is quickly becoming one of my least favorite people in sports because essentially every time the NFL's vice president of officiating comes on and explains and breaks down a controversial play, well, almost every time, he has his officials' backs. He says they did the right thing. Even when it is blatantly obvious that they did the wrong thing in many, many occasions, he is going to argue on behalf of his officials because he doesn't want them looking bad. Because if the vice president of officiating comes out on a regular basis and says, yeah, we missed that one. Yeah, we missed that one. Yeah, boy, that one was screwed up. Oh, boy, I don't know how he missed that one. It calls into question the fairness and the integrity of the sport. And in a league, I promise you he consults with Roger Goodell. I promise you he consults with the other owners or with the owners. I guarantee you that they have encouraged him that in a league that is seeing declining ratings becoming a great concern to a lot of people with a lot of money at stake, that they do not want the integrity of the game being messed with. And they don't want the VP of officiating saying, yep, our officiating has been really, really below average, really subpar. So they're going to back them no matter what. So Blandino posted a video showing DeAndre Hopkins on that play. And he said that Hopkins' heel did appear to touch the white sideline. He said that replay doesn't conclusively show that the officials were correct, but he doesn't think it shows the officials were incorrect either. So therefore, they did the right thing by blowing it dead. Quote, the right foot at the 36-yard line. Look at the heel. The heel appears to be in the white. It's not right down this down the line, so it's not definitive. But we certainly can't see he was obviously inbounds from this angle. The heel looks like it's down. It looks like it could be touching the white. It's not definitive either way. It certainly appears the foot is out of bounds. There's no way we can say this foot is clearly inbounds, and the ruling on the field was that he was out. End quote. A couple of points of contention on that. Number one, when you see wide receivers and running backs running full speed down the field for a touchdown, their heels are very rarely touching the ground. These guys are so freaking fast, they're on the balls of their feet, and they are sprinting. The heels do come down, of course, but obviously for just, I mean, milliseconds of a millisecond because of how quickly they're, you know, they're down and up. So you cannot tell. He's right about one thing. You cannot tell that his heel is on the ground over the chalk or if it is just over the chalk or the paint, as it were, and hovering over it at that particular point in time. So since you can't tell, why is he saying it certainly appears that his foot is out of bounds? He's trying to make it sound like it's more likely that it is out of bounds. He pointed out that a play like that can't be reviewed because once an official signals that a play is over by whistle, it is over. Quote, this is not reviewable. If we rule the player out, we're killing it. We're blowing whistles. You can't give an advance in replay. The theory is that players are stopping. I already discussed this already. Because of the dead ball ruling, and it would be impossible to tell where the receiver would have ended up had we not killed the play. But he basically says this call was not possible to change because the officials blew it dead because he thought that the foot was out of bounds. Never once does Blandino nor anyone else in the National Football League suggest what I just suggested, that some in the media are talking about now, and that is maybe the goal here should be to re-instruct the officials on when to swallow those freaking whistles. Let the play come to its natural end rather than your version of when it ends. And then if it wasn't out of bounds, you know, it reminds me of a scoring play. They review all scoring plays, and they do it in this exact same way. We'll see somebody, in fact, didn't it happen? Was it in the Sunday nighter? It might have been the night before in the primetime Sunday nighter. Who was in the Sunday night game? Because I watched so many doggone games over the weekend, I can't keep them all straight. I'm trying to remember who was in the Sunday night game.
Green Bay, Washington.
It might have been Green Bay, Washington. I'm trying to think who the player was who scored or who may have scored, but they actually ruled him out of bounds. I can't remember the play now. Doggone it. But I do remember it was a scoring play. And the officials actually threw their hands up. And because it was a scoring play, they, of course, review all scoring plays. And then they come to find out, oh, look at that. His pinky toe did clip the sideline there on about the 2-yard line before the ball crossed the plane. So, therefore, he stepped out. So now we mark it there and we play on. And that is exactly how it ought to be even in the middle of the field. Not the middle of the field, but I mean further up the field, not just on a scoring play. They let him play on. They called touchdown. They didn't blow it dead because they thought his foot may have hit the chalk or hit the paint. They just let the play end, and then they went back to look to see, did it or didn't it? And that's the way it ought to be. Secondly, the call this morning, if you were listening to any of this discussion on Mike and Mike, which we hope you do, we hope you listen to it each and every weekday, every morning right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. But if you listen to the discussion this morning, the call in the discussion was about whether or not technology should be brought back into play a little bit more. In other words, because Blandino says we don't have a look right down the line, the instant reaction and answer from some are to put cameras right down the line. We already have pylon cams to see if the ball crosses the plane. We got to put some more cams right down the sideline. And kind of like tennis, you know, with their sensors. And if the ball, you know,
right,
you know, trips the sensor, you hear the beep, oh, and it's obvious now. So that's one thing that they're suggesting. And while I guess I get it to a certain degree, the pylon cam certainly give great viewpoints. In fact, the pylon cam was used to overturn the one that I was just talking about. The one where the back stepped on the 2-yard line, out of bounds at the 2-yard line or so before crossing over. But I don't want to get too far out of order here, and I know it's 3:36. We've got to take a timeout. But That's one thing they talked about doing. The second thing people talk about doing is, naturally, we hear this all the time, stop making the officials part-time workers, make them full-time employees. If they study the game 12 months out of the year, they'll be better at it, and they think that'll certainly improve officiating. I'm not a fan of that one because I think that's silly. There's nothing somebody's going to be able to do in March that's going to make their eyes better or their reactions better in October. It's silly to me. But then that brings me to number three, which is the one that I would suggest as maybe an alternative to the other two. Rather than full-time officials and more technology with cameras, how about this, Jim Cushlin? How about just more officials? And what I'm thinking of, since pretty much everything in the field of play is covered, because you have a field judge, a back judge, a line judge, an umpire, and an official, and you have guys spaced out pretty much everywhere where play is going
right.
on. But what you don't have is somebody who can see specifically whether or not somebody steps out of bounds, like in a play like this, down 20 or 30 or 40 yards away from one of the side judges. Because especially if there's people like leaning over from the sideline and blocking your vision, it's hard to see everything. So here's my perspective or my idea. There's seven officials for a standard game now, right? You have seven game officials. Why not up that? And I know it's a lot, but up that by 4 to 11. And before I say, well, that's a lot of money. This is a league that makes over $10 billion a year in
with
profit.
A B.
That's after expenses.
Right.
After salaries, everything that goes into it, for crying out loud. They make over $10 billion a year in straight profit, right? So you hire four more guys per crew. And I'm not saying they have full officiating license, meaning I'm not saying give four more guys flags, because now, holy cow, you got 11 guys, everybody with a flag. I mean, every other play, somebody's going to see something and throw a flag, and the game is going to crawl to a halt, right? So what I'm saying is these guys would not be able to call pass interference on a play down the sideline. That's still going to be up to the regular official who's in the defensive secondary back there, the back judge. I think that's the back judge. I got to remember my positioning for officials. But what you would do is take four guys, put one at each 20-yard line on the sidelines. Okay? One at the 20 on each side of the field, on both ends of the field. And their job is solely to determine inbounds or out of bounds, either on catches where toe taps are important or on sprinting down the sideline like we saw yesterday with DeAndre Hopkins. If that guy right on the scene, because he at the 20, he can see everything coming at him from the 50 on toward him all the way down to the next 20 yards, down the to the end zone.
Not to mention this official in question can move up or down
exactly.
depending where the play is.
He can just move wherever he has to move, and he'll be on the spot. And that way you don't have to worry about the the side judge, I think is what it is, that is normally at the line of scrimmage, racing down the field trying to catch up to a play to see if that receiver who runs a 4.25 and this official runs about a 7.40, trying to chase him to see where his feet are with every step to see if it touches the sideline. But instead, that receiver is always going to be running toward another official who's positioned out of bounds at the 20-yard line. On each side of the field, at both ends of the field. Now, that guy is the guy that determines whether he stepped out, and he can blow the whistle right then and there because he's Johnny on the freaking spot. Or not blow the whistle and let him get into the end zone and say, we're going to go back and check it. That, to me, would seem to be the least cumbersome and the least controversial way to do this. It's not about turning officials into full-timers, and it's not about adding another four cameras or five cameras, or whatever the case might be, to the broadcast. It's simply, we have seven officials. Well, now we have our seven on-field officials. We have our four sideline officials, is what we would call them. Sideline officials, one at each 20, stationed just out of bounds, and they can move up and down the field as need be to make sure somebody stays in bounds.
Well, I'll tell you, that is one of the more interesting theories I've heard in a while, because every time I see plays like this, sometimes I get to a point, Bob, where I'm at a loss as to, how overall to fix it. And I will say that's one of the more interesting ideas I've certainly heard.
You know where I got it? You know where I got the
idea?
Please.
Baseball
playoffs.
the extra umpires down the lines.
Bingo. They add an extra. In other words, they're saying, we don't want to make a mistake here. We don't want the third base and first base umpire to have to call something way down there in the corner if it lands fair or foul or whatever the case might be. We want to make sure on the spot somebody is right there because this is the playoffs. This is world championship time. I just thought if baseball can add the umpires. Football, of course, like I said, they don't have 162 games for each team.
Right.
You got 16 weeks of football. You know, you got 16 games going on in a given weekend, essentially. Usually, you know, once you get into the byes, you got, maybe 12 or 13 games going on. You can afford to put four more guys on. They're sideline officials. They'll be called sideline officials and add them to the crew just like baseball does in the playoffs.
Well, again, I'll close by saying that that is one of the more interesting ideas that I've heard in a while. And either way, at some point, something has to be done because we're basically in the football officials version, Bob, of this.
Poor caddying. Want to be replaced by golf carts. Just keep it up.
that's pretty much what we're talking about. You want the humans to be replaced by some sort of mechanical eyes, then you keep messing up like this. All right, I know we're way past our break time here, so let's get a quick time out here. We'll come back. We're going to talk. I want to take your phone calls on this. How would you best improve officiating? Do you like my idea of adding more officials to the crew, not more flag-bearing officials, where you have more flags hitting the ground and more of a slowdown in the game, but just sideline judges to make sure that anything that is inbounds or out of bounds is known right out of the gate, right at that particular moment in time, so that we don't have these, oh, my God, look at that. I guess we should have given the guy the 65-yard touchdown, but sorry, you get a 24-yard game because we blew it dead. You got somebody right there on the spot. Or do you like the idea of more cameras and more technology? You tell me how you feel about it at 866-240-1065 right here on the ticket.
Hook up with us on Facebook. Search Facebook /1065 The Ticket. Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Onward we roll right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Hey, I got something cool for you here coming up at the end of the hour. We got a sweet deal this week. If you love Sideline Sports Bar and Grill, four great locations, two in Toledo, I will be asking you to call in about 7 or 8 minutes from now, probably about 7 minutes from now. Don't do it yet. Don't bother dialing now. But I will have a great opportunity for you to win a $50 gift certificate to Sidelines. You can also, of course, get a great deal on one for just $25 tomorrow morning. Starting at 9 o'clock at 1065theticket.com, but that'll be coming up in just a bit. Hey, I want to get back to this issue of officiating in the National Football League. Once again, just a number of terrible calls in a primetime game. And this seems to be, you know, kind of a pattern, kind of a habit, I think, don't you? That whenever the NFL has the brightest spotlights upon it, it seems to fail the worst, and it seems to fall the hardest, and more of these things continue to be exposed. And right now, the game is not being officiated fairly for a number of teams in a number of ways. What's really interesting to me, too, Jim, and I worked very closely with the Oakland Raiders for about three seasons at the turn of the decade, or at the turn of the century, I should say, of the millennium, starting in 2000. And you know as well as I do that there is a severe, not inferiority complex, what's the word looking for? Paranoia. There's a paranoia. Most Raider fans, because of Al Davis, going back to the late Al Davis, who was constantly at odds with the National Football League, suing Pete Rozelle, moving his team multiple times, all of this stuff. The belief was that the league was always out to get the Raiders, and they're going to flag the Raiders for more penalties than everybody else. They're going to blow calls if there is a controversial one. It's going to go against the Raiders. That's just how the franchise kind of operates, and that's how the fan base certainly feels even to this day. And it's ironic that last night it was a couple of blown calls or questionable calls, to say the very least, that went in favor of the Raiders. So maybe that's I don't know, is that just coincidental, or is that just ironic, or is that just an acknowledgement that Al Davis doesn't run the show anymore since he passed away, and it's his family's now. And the league has forgiven everything with the Raiders, or maybe the Raider fans are just ridden with paranoia. So, how do you think they best solve the problem? I suggest more officials being on the field. Seven officials. If you don't know, by the way, how it works, just to kind of run through it. There are seven officials on the field at one time in a National Football League game. There's a referee. There's an umpire. There's a head linesman. There's a line judge. There's a back judge. There's a field judge. and then there's a side judge. Each of them has a very unique responsibility. They all can throw flags for a variety of things. It's not as if one person can only call pass interference if somebody else notices it, for example. But what I'm talking about is not adding another flag thrower to the equation. I'm simply talking about line judges, meaning sideline judges. Somebody that is on each sideline at about the 20-yard line looking up and down the field whenever there's a play at the sideline. So if there's a question about possession and toe-tapping, that guy makes that call. He will not make a call on pass interference. That is up to, I think it's the field judge that is in the far back, you know, in the secondary. So that would be up to that person to call pass interference. But in terms of, were his feet in? Did he have possession? Did he, or if it's somebody racing down the sideline on a running play or catching a run, did he step out of bounds or did he stay in? That guy's one job, you know, the old cliche we all use. You had one job. Your one job would be to look at the chalk or look at the paint on the sideline and see if feet are touching it or if they're not. See if toes tap and drag or if they don't. If an elbow or a knee gets down in bounds before a wild possession is established or not. All of that stuff just simply belongs to the side judge or the sideline judge. It would not involve flag throwing. That, to me, is my best solution for this whole thing. I'm not suggesting there is not a place for more technology. Maybe there is. Certainly they've improved the view that we get of the plane, if you will, the goal line plane, by way of the pylon cam. And we do get a view of down the sideline if they have the camera facing the other way on the pylon. So that can certainly help. But I do like those things, but I do think you also need to have more officials covering more areas of the field to make sure that the right call plays are or the right calls are made on given plays. So that's what I think. I'm interested in your thoughts at 866-240-1065. You may also tweet your thoughts to us at Sports Radio 1065 or Facebook comment on this issue and more at 1065 The Ticket. Your thoughts on that are certainly welcome. I know that's what the Houston Texans wish they would have had yesterday, Jim Cushlin, and I feel like they kind of got robbed on this one. And to me, it doesn't matter that it's the Houston Texans and the Oakland Raiders. It could have been the Cleveland Browns and the Arizona Cardinals, and I would still be saying the same thing. I want the calls to be right.
Yeah.
This is a multi-billion-dollar profiteering league each and every year. Spend a few hundred thousand more on four more game officials to work every single game, and I think we have our problem. If not solved, we eliminate a lot of the mistakes that have been made.
Yeah.
Including, by the way, you know, the catch, you know, that the Lions got screwed on in the playoffs a couple of years ago, the play with Anthony Hitchens and the pass interference, including the play in which Dez Bryant kind of got screwed on the completion of the process or the process of the completion of the catch or whatever they call it. If you have another person there who can be right there on the spot and make the right call on the field, even if there then is a challenge, you know the deal. A challenge has to, in order for them to reverse a play, the challenge has to show, or the video has to show, irrefutable evidence that the call on the field was the wrong call. If you add those four other guys in those strategic positions I made, or that I described, there is a much better chance of getting the right call on the field, and thus the burden for overturning the wrong call is lessened when you get to the challenge flag. And that, to me, I think would, like I said, it would improve the quality of the officiating and thus the game immeasurably.
Yeah, I think it would too, and part of this is that I'm leaning towards what you're saying with the extra bodies out there instead of just
eight
cameras, is because of this reviewable nature. That we also have to have a long discussion, I think, overall, the NFL does, of what's reviewable and what's not. Most times it seems like nobody knows what's reviewable and what's not.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. You are definitely right about that, and that's kind of what I'm talking about. I think this would just kind of provide a lot of clarity on the field. Let me get a quick one in here before the top of the hour, because I do want to get to our guest. Sean Corp is going to join us coming up at about 4:10. Greg in Toledo, some thoughts on the officiating and what we saw last night and how to best move forward. Greg, go ahead, sir.
First of all, I'm a huge Oakland Raiders fan. Glad they're doing well this season, but I will say that after watching the game last night, there was a ton of missed calls, as you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, and that seems to be a regular occurrence these days. By the way, you must have had a miserable last decade and a half as a Raiders fan.
It's been brutal. You know, Russell, Brooks, all of them. It's been really, really rough, but the season's been a lot of fun so far.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So what do you think is the best way to move going forward to eliminate some of those missed calls?
I kind of had a out-of-the-box idea.
All right.
I was thinking, in essence, if you were thinking of, like, think of, like, a dog fence, like a wire.
Right.
if they ran something where they had a sensor in your shoes, and if they crossed that line on the outside of the lines, and then the sensor would go off. So in essence, you would use some kind of technology, and that way
The thing with that is, two things with that, actually. Number one is that is really outside the box. It would be really
right.
interesting to put a sensor in every shoe. I think that would be a little bit cumbersome. But the worst part about it for me is that everybody would have to have them in their shoes. And let's say DeAndre Hopkins, as an example, since we had last night's play, is streaking down the sideline, and his shoe goes over the side, but he doesn't step out of bounds. He crosses the plane of out of bounds, which is what a sensor would pick up. But he didn't step out of bounds. Now you would have that play being blown dead because the sensor went off. Secondly, what if the guy who's chasing him down the sidelines and he does step out of bounds and he's got the same sensor that Hopkins does, and the Raiders player steps out of bounds while trying to chase him down, and boom, suddenly there's the sensor and boom, blow the play dead.
Right. Yeah.
Now we got a problem there. So that's the reason why, again, I like the idea of a human, set of four more sets of human eyes, 8 more eyes on the job.
Yeah, that's true. But even with added officials on the sidelines, you're still going to have human error.
Oh yeah, I'm not suggesting that my idea would cure all ills. You're still going to have problems. You're still going to have mistakes. You're 100% right about that. And thanks for the call, Greg. I got to bail because I got to get to the top of the hour Sports Center here. But I think it would drastically decrease the number of those incidents, and those incidents seem to be in the opposite side right now. There is a drastic increase in the number of blown calls and an increase in the or a decrease in the quality overall of officiating, and it's causing a lot of problems in a lot of fans' eyes, and maybe that's one of the things reflected in the lower ratings. All right, hey, I told you I'd give you this, so let me give this to you now. If you are the 8th caller to 866-240-1065, 8th caller, to 866-240-1065. I've got that $50 gift certificate to Sidelines Sports Bar and Grill for you. 4 great locations, 2 of them in Toledo, 1 in Maumee, and another one in Lambertville. And that $50 gift certificate is yours if you're the 8th caller. If you don't get it as the 8th caller, you still have a great opportunity to get a $50 gift certificate for just $25, half price, tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. at 1065theticket.com while supplies last. Good luck to you. And we're going to talk NBA and the move of the Pistons from the Palace to downtown Detroit. Sean Corp of DetroitBadBoys.com joins us next right here on the Ticket.
Unique in that it's at the highest level in terms of competition on the field. We've got a hot hand in that regard. It's a great opportunity and a tremendous challenge. It's a large task. It's a tremendous challenge. They're great. They're a great, great football team. Great coaching. Any big game, any championship game, also any road game, they're going to pack your defense. Our guys will be up for the challenge. Look forward to a great week of preparation. Getting ready to play this game.
Well, I go back, I'm 52, so probably 40-some years that I grew up in northeastern Ohio, and my family were big Woody Hayes fans and Ohio State fans, and for some reason, to this day, I still don't know, but I do remember it. My mom said, hey, you have to go run an errand, and I threw a fit, and I was 6 years old or something, and so sure enough, we go run an errand, and it was colder than cold, and we went to some outdoor mall in Ashtabula, Ohio, and I remember I was so upset that I had to leave the TV, and over the loudspeakers outside of the mall, I would stand and listen to the game while she was shopping and doing whatever she had to do.
I think there's 3 things. Horrendously bad second quarter defensively, where we didn't put anything into the game. Getting out-rebounded again. It's become a habit of ours. If you look, only 2 guys rebounded. 2 starting forwards get 4 between them in, 55 minutes. That isn't going to be good enough. Our inability to convert in the paint. We got 2 more shots in the paint than they did, and they scored 14 more points in the paint than we did. To shoot under 40% in the paint is pretty difficult. Look, I thought we did a pretty good job on James Harden other than the fouls, and it's just really tough not to foul him. I mean, the stuff they give him in call is just, I guess that's the way they're going to continue to call it, but it's hard.
It's tough. I mean, that's 4 in a row, 4 or 5 in a row. We got to find it within ourselves to pick it up and get wins. What got us the lead was we were moving the ball, being ourselves, and then the ball just stopped moving.
finally happening. What's been a topic of conversation for so long now and what's been rumored for so many years become officially a done deal. Pistons owner Tom Gores and the Illich family will announce the Pistons' move back to Detroit. The Pistons are going to move into Little Caesars Arena with the Red Wings. This move has been in the works since Tom Gores bought the Pistons from the Davison family. He hired former sports agent Arne Tellem to boost the team's profile within the city and also, very openly, to lead the team's move downtown.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Tell you what, there's a lot of fertile ground there to plow in the montage as we begin hour number two of the Extravaganza this Tuesday afternoon. Thanks again for being with us. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff there. Good stuff there from Urban Meyer in the early going, talking about the matchup with Michigan. A really, really great story reminiscing there, too, about growing up and listening to those games. It's going to be a classic, make no mistake. It's going to be a classic on Saturday at the Horseshoe. But all of that Detroit stuff, really, really key. How about Andre Drummond? How about Stan Van Gundy kind of complaining, well, you know, he didn't like some of the calls against him, but if that's the way they're going to do it. He made the decision. He had to make a call. He had to decide whether he wanted to leave Andre Drummond on the floor for rebounding and, you know, knowing full well that chances are very, very good that the Rockets are going to foul him intentionally in a tight game, and that's exactly what they did. He has missed. Let me see if I have this from Sean Corp on DetroitBadBoys.com. Yeah, he was one of six overall. He is three of his last 12 at the line, and he missed the two that could have sent the game to overtime. And that's what kind of kept him busy and at work long after everybody else was gone home. He was staying, according to Sean's story, he was staying there to practice his free throws well after the game at the Palace last night after the loss to Houston. And with that, we bring in Sean Corp, who writes about the Pistons for DetroitBadBoys.com and SB Nation website. Sean, thanks for the time, man. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good. I want to get to the Palace and the move from Auburn Hills back to downtown Detroit or to downtown Detroit in just a minute or two. But let's talk about the loss yesterday. Let's talk about kind of the state of the Pistons. And let's talk about Andre Drummond. It is such a painful thing to see. To see a guy with his, you know, work ethic, with his, you know, who's so likable, which he is, who's such a great player in so many other phases of the game, who we know takes this stuff seriously and dedicated himself in the off season to improve, who just can't get this right. It's painful to see him have to either come out of the game or be left in the game to rebound and be stuck, you know, doing this thing that he just can't do very well. It's just, I wish there was an answer, but there isn't, other than to say it's just terrible and it's painful to watch.
Well, I guess I won't disagree with you there. He is getting better compared to last year. So he's kind of at that threshold where you want your big man to be, that 50% line where the intentional fouls become much less likely. Mm-hmm. It just so happened that they were down two, so they felt pretty good about him missing at least one. So they took the foul there. I think that probably would have happened with a lot of big men in the league. But definitely somebody with a history of Andre Drummond, he kind of had a chance to prove his doubters wrong, and he wasn't able to do it last night.
Yeah, because what did he finish last year at about, like 35, 36%, something like that?
Yeah, it was the worst performance from the free throw line in NBA history. It was about 35%.
Which is insane. And I know now, as in your article, as you commented, he's at 47% right now, and that's obviously about a 10, 12-point jump or more from last season, but it's still below 50%. I got to believe that this is something, I don't care who you are, you know, you're going to do this as long as he's in the game, and if it's a close game, you're going to do this, especially when you consider the fact that that huge improvement isn't something he has proven he can do for an entire year. He's done it now for roughly a month or a little bit less than a month, however many, you know, since we started this thing. So I got to believe I'm going to roll the dice, and I'm going to keep putting this guy on the line in every opportunity I can with the game on the line.
Yeah, and that was actually one of the first times this season where he's been intentionally fouled with the express purpose of putting him on the line. Mm-hmm. Previous to that, they were just natural fouls in the course of the action, and he wasn't able to deliver. It's kind of disheartening, but, I mean, anyone who thought that he was going to fix these problems in one off season was deluding themselves. So you have to take that incremental improvement and hope he can build on it, because really, all evidence points to this being more of a mental block than something exactly. physical that he can't do. So the more he sees the ball go in the hoop, the more comfortable he's going to be, and the more likely when the game is on the line, he's going to be able to hit those at some point.
Did he speak after the game, or did the reporters all have to bail because he was still practicing free throws?
As far as I know, he basically spent all his time out on the floor and didn't speak to the media.
And again, that's really, you know, a great thing. You know, it's a wonderful thing because, again, it shows how seriously he takes this. And I know he's not doing that for show. He's doing it to get better. But I'm just curious as to what he says, what he has to say about these things right now, especially since this is the first time this year that he was intentionally fouled, as you say, with the express purpose of putting him on the line. He is working on it, but I feel as though what you said is true. When you said anybody who thinks he was going to fix this in one off season is delusional, I kind of feel like anybody who thinks he's going to fix this, period, and the sentence there, or pause it there and say, is delusional. And the reason why isn't that he isn't going to try, but it's hard to translate and transfer that mental comfort you have in the gym by yourself. And you just pointed out, I think, in your article that he was hitting about 80% of his free throws in the post game, so when it didn't matter. But there's a big difference between that and, of course, when the pressure is on and everybody is watching in a packed arena when you need to. And you've got to get that done to send a game to overtime. That's something I don't think any amount of practicing in an empty gym can fix.
Well, I mean, I think there is the case that he can be what is, you know, typical of a poor free throw shooting big man, which is that 50 to 60% range. He's not going to become Ray Allen. Even if he shoots 80% in the gym, he'll never shoot that well in a game. I mean, everybody shoots better during practice than they do in real game situations. So he's not ever going to be a non-liability at the free throw line, but really what you want out of him is somebody that you don't have to take him out of games and you don't risk the chance that he's hacked to put him on the free throw line. And to get there, you really only need to be about a 50% free throw shooter. So that's about where he is, and the steps he took in the off season, he used some virtual reality training, which a lot of teams are doing now, and he really changed his routine. He kind of elongated it and broke it down so that he was forced to do the same thing every time instead of just standing at the free throw line and risking the chance that he was going to mess up his mechanics.
Sure, sure. And again, I applaud. I really mean this. You know, I have complained in the past. We're talking to Sean Corp of DetroitBadBoys.com covering the Pistons and talking about last night's loss and now talking about Andre Drummond. We'll get to the entirety of the loss in a moment here. And Jim's got a question for you, too. But I have complained in the past about people saying, oh, we got to change the rules. We got to change the rules because it's a mockery of the game. They're fouling these guys to put them on the line when they know they can't shoot free throws and blah, blah, blah. And I've always said, you know, you don't change the rules to protect two or three guys who can't shoot 30 or 40% from the foul line. You just make those guys get better. And if you don't get better, then you end up on the bench. I've always been that way. But I don't say that with malice, and I don't say that with any ill will toward Andre Drummond, because I really firmly believe he is trying everything he can to get better at this. He's dedicated to it, and that's why it's so frustrating. So I really, really hope that, you know, whether it's a virtual reality or all the other things you're talking about, he can get up near 50%. If he forget about 60. I don't think that's ever going to happen. And the 47 he's at now, I need to see that for 82 games, not just for, you know, 15 or however many games there has been played thus far. Before we'll know that he's close to even 50. Jim Cushion's got one for you. Sean, go ahead, Jim.
You know, and in the overall grand scheme of things, Sean, this is a team now that has lost 7 of 10 and 4 in a row since they blew the doors off a couple weeks ago of Russell Westbrook and the Thunder. There's a lot of reasons for that. Stan Van Gundy and the montage we all just heard, talking about some rebounding and some things in addition to this that was going wrong. In your opinion, Sean, what's the biggest reason for the current skid up by these Pistons?
Well, if I was going to pick the biggest reason, I'd say it's the point guard play. I think you've seen the last couple of weeks that Ish Smith is a huge minus on the offensive end at point guard. And to combine that with Andre Drummond, who can't create much offense on his own, that basically means the Pistons are playing 3-on-5 on the offensive end with only a few threats. And when you have essentially five people guarding three dangerous offensive players, it becomes a very easy scheme to break. So I don't know if this is going to be able to turn around until Reggie Jackson gets back from injury, because He's just light years more dangerous on the offensive end than Ish Smith right now.
Yeah, and you know, by the way, you put it more gentle in answer to Jim's question than you did in your column, in which you do your game story. I mean, Andre Drummond and Ish Smith were offensive black holes, which is a pretty harsh way of saying. But you're right; they combined to shoot 9 of 27 in the game, and Drummond getting the ball almost exclusively was with his back to the basket, which is not his best way of contributing offensively. So you're 100% right about that. My question to follow up on what Jim asked you and what you just said is, how much better can Reggie Jackson make this offense when he comes back? Remember, he's going to have his own, you know, rust to work out, as he has not played for these first however many games it is now. What is the number, by the way? I didn't exactly
know. They're 6-9, so 15.
I said 15. I was right. Okay, I thought it was right around there. Anyway, you know, when he comes back, he's going to have to get himself into game shape and round himself into form and shake the rust off. How much better can he make this team when he does get back?
Well, I think it'll be somewhat of a process, but the one thing he's going to provide is the threat of being able to score. That's not even something that Ish Smith is providing right now. Essentially, the defender can sag off of every screen that Andre Drummond sets, and when you see Ish Smith go into the lane, you can tell, and the defenders can tell, he's not really looking to score at the basket. He's looking for a pass on the perimeter, which means everyone gets to stay home close to their defensive assignment. With Reggie Jackson, even if he doesn't really convert very efficiently as he shakes the rust off, he's somebody that can hit a three-pointer, and he's somebody that's going to constantly attack looking to score. That's the kind of movement that forces the defenders to react. That's going to open up the perimeter. That's going to open up some alley-oop opportunities for Andre Drummond, and just none of that is there right now, and that's why the offense is so stagnant.
Sean Corp joining us from DetroitBadBoys.com. The main reason we reached out to you today, Sean, is to talk about the big news of the Pistons moving from the Palace at Auburn Hills, about, 30 miles or so, down back to downtown Detroit, and they're going to play at Little Caesars with the Red Wings. What does this mean to the basketball team? I mean, to the community, it's very cool. I think it's very good. Dan Gilbert, the Cavaliers owner, tweeted something about this today, saying that this puts all 30 NBA teams either right at the core of their inner city or urban, the urban cores of the cities they represent, or very, very near it. And it's a great thing for the city. And there's going to be an economic impact there. But from a basketball impact, does this impact the way they play the game? Will it do anything for, you know, the home court advantage with the fans? Will there be better attendance, or I should say there's going to be better attendance, or always is with a new building. Will the better attendance or more sellouts have an impact? How does it affect the team on the floor, if at all?
Well, I think it'll definitely have an impact, only because it's been a lot of years since there was a real home court advantage for the Pistons. A lot of that had to do with the team being bad, kind of in that post-going-to-work era. But even as the product on the court has improved, the attendance is not. It's often a sparsely filled arena, and you know, one knock you can have against Andre Drummond and a lot of his young teammates, and this is a very young team, is they're not feeding off of any energy, and there's a lot of times where they play kind of lethargic, and so any kind of hometown boost that you can get, I mean, the Palace right now, despite the middling record for the Pistons, it's dead last in the league as far as percent filled. It's 69%. They're one of the worst teams in the league for attendance, despite being a pretty good team. So, you know, as much as I love the Palace, and that's where I grew up watching basketball, it just didn't look like the community was going to embrace a turnaround, and moving probably made the most sense.
Yeah, it's a really good point, and certainly it should lead, of course, as we mentioned, to an increase in attendance. It can't really drop any much more than what you just described. But do you think that is something that they will feed off well enough to actually show improvement in the product? And the reason I ask that is obviously, there is that novelty feeling, or that novelty effect, I guess I should say, whenever there's a new ballpark or arena built. And again, I was in Cleveland in the mid-1990s, early 1990s, when they built what is now known as Gateway, and then it was Gund Arena and Jacobs Field. And there's a novelty that everybody wants to go and see the games in the new buildings for a while. And then after a while, it's not a novelty anymore. It's, okay, that's just the building. And if the team isn't good, and if the team isn't giving me a reason to come, I'm not going to buy tickets just to go down there and look at the cool new architecture. I need to see a product that I can believe in before, you know, I'm going to keep coming back. So from an improvement standpoint, you're going to get that boost from the fans, certainly, and have that real home court advantage for a while. But pretty soon, the fans are going to dictate, or excuse me, the play is going to dictate whether those fans keep coming.
Yeah, and I think that this was a very intentional timeline decision by Tom Gores ever since he bought the team. Once he kind of cut bait on Joe Dumars and went with Stan Van Gundy, people thought, oh, he's going to be win now, because when a coach is the GM, that's what they do. But every move Stan Van Gundy's made has really been a long-term investment in young talent that they're hoping can grow. And so what you're seeing now is a very young team. Almost all the players in their rotation are super young. And they're, you know, that borderline playoff team, that seventh, eighth seed, hoping to jump up to the sixth or fifth seed this year, and banking on internal improvement to really take the team to the next level. So the timeline, you know, if it's a bad team and they move into new arena, then it's not going to last. They're still going to be a bad team at the end of the day. But you're seeing a new, young nucleus moving into a new arena to generate excitement, and they're hoping they can sort of forge their own identity and become a mainstay with the move to the new building.
Sean Corp is our guest covering the Detroit Pistons for DetroitBadBoys.com. Jim Cushion's got one more for you there. Jimmy, go ahead.
You know, and thinking about this from a more longer-term point of view, and you mentioned it, and I'm pretty much the same way. When it comes to the Pistons, I've always seen them in the Palace, but, you know, before that, they were in the Silver Dome. Before that, there was a brief period of time where they shared the Joe Louis Arena when it was newer at the time. But for all intents and purposes, the Detroit Pistons for a number of decades have obviously been playing at not some kind of small arena and or downtown. So that just, that dynamic in general, what might that do from a fan base perspective, regardless of what Bob's saying, which is true? I think that you're going to have that novelty at first, but then if their winning's not there, it's going to start to wear off. But again, in general, this is a Pistons franchise that for a long, long time has either played in weird arenas from a basketball perspective or have been playing far away from the more center part of Detroit. So what will this do overall to the fan base in general, you think?
Well, I think one thing that Detroit has had, even when they're in the Palace, is that their team identity and the blueprint of their success very much was in line with the community within Detroit, that sort of lunch pail ethic, sort of unsung heroes taking the team to the next level. So I think that when they're good, the community always has a reason to try and get behind the Pistons, and now it's just, you know, they're going to go from having the work ethic of the people of Detroit to being located in and around the people of Detroit. So it just makes it easier for that community to embrace the team and see it grow going forward.
Sean Corp joining us from DetroitBadBoys.com. A great site, a great job, obviously. We appreciate it. We like to read and follow your work online, and we certainly appreciate when you come on the air and join us as well. Sean, thanks so much for the time.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime.
All right. Have a great day. There you go. Sean Corp with a breakdown of the Pistons, not only on the court, but obviously, well, where the court is. The new building, of course, yet to be completed, but it will be in time, of course, for next season, and they will be back downtown. Okay. Here's what we are going to do. We're going to take a time out here. And then I kind of told Jim Cush on this before yesterday's show. I want to spend a little time every day of the week on Ohio State and Michigan. Yesterday, we spent a good deal of time talking about the matchup on Saturday with Bill Conley of SBNation.com, kind of an outsider's non-biased perspective. He favors the Buckeyes. The rest of the week, we're going to be talking daily to Michigan and or Ohio State writers and supporters to kind of get their perspective on how this is going to shake out on Saturday at the Horseshoe. So coming up after the bottom of the hour sports break here, we're going to get Luke Zimmerman on the line. He's from LandGrantHolyLand.com. That is an Ohio State Buckeyes SB Nation fan site. And we're going to get Luke's perspective on JT Barrett against that rock-solid, maybe best defense in the nation, Michigan defense, and whether or not Wilton Spate is going to be able to go for Michigan and how his presence or absence will impact this game from that side of the football. So we're going to get Luke Zimmerman of LandGrantHolyLand.com on today. Tomorrow, We're going to have Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. He will join us to talk about things, obviously, from the Ohio State perspective. We will have a Michigan guest tomorrow as well, as yet unnamed, and the same thing will happen on Friday. We'll have Buckeye and Wolverine guests the day before the game as well. Obviously, you notice I skipped over Thursday because Thanksgiving Thursday, we will not have a live show. We will have tons of live NFL football. Three games, Vikings, Lions, Cowboys, Redskins, Steelers, Colts. Going to be a very, very fun time on Thanksgiving Day. But for now, a quick timeout. Oh, by the way, congratulations to Ryan Norowski. I think
Winorski.
That W is probably solid.
Winorski.
There you go. Okay. Winorski. Okay. I'll trust you, but I don't like that spelling. I think you maybe misspelled it. Ryan Winorski of Maumee was the winner of our sweet deal. Don't forget, you can be a winner tomorrow morning online at 1065theticket.com, a $50 gift certificate to Sidelines Sports Bar and Grill for just $25 starting at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Right back with Luke Zimmerman of LandGrantHolyLand.com after this timeout on ESPN 1065 The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on, are we? It is 4:41. We got 19 minutes of outstanding awesomeness left for you on this Tuesday edition of the Extravaganza from the NBA and the Pistons' big move to the big game rivalry week. Of course, we want to give it its due attention each and every day this week, talking to Michigan and Ohio State supporters and or media. And to that end, we say good afternoon once again to Luke Zimmerman, joining us from LandGrantHolyLand.com. That's an Ohio State site as a part of SB Nation. Hey, Luke, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me back again.
It's a pleasure to have you back, man. We always enjoy the conversation, especially in a week like this, as, you know, it all comes down to it. I read a really interesting piece on a different website today that we are 10 years removed from one of the classic all-time Ohio State-Michigan games. It was 2006. That top-ranked Ohio State and I believe number two at the time, Michigan, went to battle, and or maybe it was vice versa. I'm trying to remember how it came down in 2006. I got to go back and double check that, but it was a 42-39 thriller that darn near resulted in a rematch, in a national championship game rematch. But Lloyd Carr would not fight for that rematch, and Urban Meyer campaigned openly for the BCS officials to declare Florida to be the challenger for Ohio State in the national championship game, and the rest, as we know, is history. So a decade on, we are maybe potentially set here, Luke, for you know, that kind of a rematch.
Yeah, I think this is clearly the most high-stakes game we've had in the series and the rivalry since that one. You know, I think when you had just two teams ultimately being selected to play for the national championship, as opposed to the current system that rewards four teams, there's still some politicking, certainly, but it's not, you know, we remember, you know, Mack Brown famously trying to go to bat for his team, and Cal kind of getting squeezed out of a game, and like you mentioned, Urban Meyer when he's in the Florida doing the same thing for the Gators, and that just came with the territory, and you still see that, you know, now with Art Briles, formerly at Baylor and TCU, when they were left out in favor of the Buckeyes. I think also, like, history in a lot of these matchups tend to kind of, I guess, I don't like to say validate after the fact, but, you know, we see some of that where, you know, Ohio State wins the national title in 2014, or TCU and Baylor really that wrong. Florida, unfortunately, wins that 2006 national title pretty emphatically over the Buckeyes. I don't think Michigan, who also lost their postseason game, had too much of a complaint after that. So I think, you know, we'll see. The best team will win. I think in this case, there probably will not be a rematch, but it should be interesting to see how it plays out.
Who is in a better position going into the end of this one? And what I mean by that is as far as playing better right now. I think if we look back to the previous 2 weeks prior to the Michigan State one-point escape at East Lansing, Ohio State was playing its best football of the season in back-to-back 62-3 wins, one against number 10 Nebraska and then the other against unranked Maryland. But then we did have 17-16, and we did come from a questionable decision to go for two by Mark D'Antonio to maybe being in overtime against the Spartans, and that is where the Buckeyes come in. Meanwhile, Michigan comes off of the loss to Iowa, unranked, and then, you know, kind of a lackluster 20-10 win over Indiana with a backup quarterback. So who's got momentum, if anybody does, right now going into Sunday or Saturday at the Horseshoe?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we saw these two teams play last week, Ohio State clearly would have had the edge there. Michigan's coming off a loss against Iowa where, you know, not only did Walton Spade get injured, but he just really wasn't that good before the injury. Michigan was never able to kind of get into any kind of groove and kind of seemed to be victims of that atmosphere kind of on the road in Iowa City at night, which can certainly be a hostile place for anybody to play. And Ohio State, like you said, was coming off these two huge blowout wins where the offense finally looked alive and looked confident. I think, you know, more so than anything, despite all of JT Barrett's struggles this season, you know, I still in my heart of hearts feel so much of it has been mental, just sort of the toll of the last 2-3 years on him. So for him to kind of look confident and comfortable, you know, after just blowing out teams consecutively, I think would have been great. This week, you know, it's really hard, I think, still to take a ton of meaning out of last week's games. Both not only had sort of that look ahead factor where Ohio State and Michigan are both, you know, not taking their opponents for granted. Neither coach has ever allowed that, but you know, it's just impossible not to ignore that siren call of the game. You know, it's just, you can't do it. So, I think that, and then just both games were played in just inclement weather. It's, you know, we've seen Ohio State. I've never seen a team in 20 plus years of watching, covering football, just, you know, struggle with the elements the way Ohio State has this season. They've had, what, 6-7 games, it seems like, where they've played in either rain or sleet or cold, or it's just, it's ridiculous. But I think, you know, we'll let last week be last week. Both teams are, you know, this is their season. This is, you know, Urban Meyer said today that, you know, they plan all year for this game. And I think both sides do that. So, you know, you can toss a lot of that out the window. You know, momentum is, you know, tomorrow's starting pitcher used to be the, I think, the Earl Weaver expression in baseball. Like, momentum is JT Barrett versus John O'Connor, Walton Spate. And that's what the bottom line is come Saturday.
That's a very important point. We're talking with Luke Zimmerman of LandGrantHolyLand.com. That's an SB Nation Ohio State Buckeye website. As long as we're on the subject of anniversaries, and we mentioned 10 years ago that classic 42-39 thriller, number one Ohio State over number two Michigan, it's been 30 years almost to the day since Jim Harbaugh last stepped foot into Ohio Stadium. And that was the week that he guaranteed victory. And he said, I think it was on Tuesday of that week, that we will beat Ohio State and we will be in the Rose Bowl on January 1st. He guaranteed it Joe Namath style and then delivered a 26-24 win. He hasn't been back yet. I know that nostalgia doesn't really count for any points in a game like this, but I just feel like that the Jim Harbaugh factor is going to make an appearance here. He is going to impact this game with points in some way or another, and I don't mean the obvious. Every coach devises game plans, et cetera. But just the emotion, the way he's able to fire up his guys, all of those kinds of things that makes him, you know, one of the great coaches in college football every place he's been thus far. I feel like he's going to have an impact on the game in terms of points in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think, you know, I thought the same thing last year, and that didn't quite pan out for a variety of reasons. But if you remember, the first half was real tight, and I think that's sort of the game that we're going to be in for. If you look at last year's first half between Ohio State and Michigan and Ann Arbor before Ohio State, just, you know, a lot of the times, even blowouts, they just, there's like a tipping point where things just get out of hand, and the game's really, you know, you see this sometimes with Alabama too. Like, they have these big dominant wins, and it wasn't really like as dominant of a game, despite how good they are and how much they can overwhelm their opposition with their talent. It's just that the game is actually just a couple plays, you know, even in these 21-point wins. Ohio State won, what, 42-13 last year? I think the game was closer than the score indicated, to be honest. I think this year we will sort of see that, and I think you're right. Something I think a Big Ten assistant coach, you know, there's one of those sourced reports, so you never know how really accurate or reliable or who this person is. Is it a graduate assistant, is it a coordinator? But supposedly a Big Ten assistant said this past offseason, I believe, that what makes Michigan so hard to prepare for is you watch all this game tape and then you go on to play them, and that game that you play them, they do stuff offensively that has not been in any of the tapes that you watched. So at this point, Urban Meyer and his staff have broken down, you know, 11 Michigan games this year, 13 games last year, and they're going to do stuff that they haven't done in any of those 24 games. And I think that's difficult to prepare for. I think the hard part for Michigan, and this sort of factors in, Ohio State fans remember, you know, going into that Sugar Bowl against Arkansas, that there was just this monkey on their back that they couldn't beat an SEC team. And it's unfair because you're talking 3-4 different coaches over 30, 40 years with different players. And, you know, it's sort of just one of these tropes that I think psychologically, though, can really impact the current student athletes. I think Michigan is facing that kind of anti-momentum right now, where their players aren't just battling Ohio State, they're battling, you know, almost a decade of futility against their rivals. And we see this sometimes in Florida State, we see this in, you know, Texas, Oklahoma. You just get these sort of almost like snowball effects where you get behind, you start to doubt that you can do it. So if Michigan, if Jim Harbaugh can bring some of that same sort of mentality that he brought when he called his own shot effectively and predicted a win and then delivered on it, then I think Michigan will have every shot to go into Ohio Stadium and pull the upset.
Yeah, there is that, you know, that what's the word I'm looking for? Not emotional lift that he can provide, but just that I guess I'll have to stick with emotional. I can't seem to rack my internal thesaurus here and find a better word that I think he can provide. But let's go back to last year, because you said that you thought the game was closer than the score indicated in Harbaugh's first matchup against Ohio State with Urban Meyer as the head coach there. I didn't see it that way. I felt like they played their worst. I felt like Ohio State dominated them from start to finish, even though the score wasn't as big at halftime, as you point out. I feel like they played their worst game, but I also attribute a lot of that to that incomprehensible loss to Michigan State that kind of just took all of the wind out of their season sails. When you drop that punt snap and then, of course, have that incomprehensible return with zeros on the clock for the touchdown, it just sucked everything out of them. And I feel like if they were playing for maybe last year, even a spot at the playoffs in that last game, I feel like it would have been or could have been different. And now, of course, they are. They're both playing for a spot in the playoffs. Michigan, of course, would have to. How interesting is this, too, Luke? Michigan would have to win two games to make the playoffs. Ohio State would essentially only have to win this one because they don't have to go to the Big Ten championship game, according to almost all conventional wisdom here. If they beat Michigan, the number three team in the top in the college football playoff rankings right now, it doesn't matter if Penn State or Wisconsin wins the Big Ten championship. The Buckeyes get the Big Ten bid, if you will, to the title game. Michigan's got to win twice.
Yeah, I think that is a little bit of interesting, you know, game theory. I don't know how much that factors into these guys' psychological advantages, because it's just like, this is both teams' Super Bowl, and if you can't get up for this game, you shouldn't bother playing for either team. I do want to at least double back a little bit and clarify what I said. Did not really say that it was as close as the score indicated. I meant more along the lines of, I think a lot of Michigan fans and beat writers were saying stuff along the lines of, well, Michigan just really has a long way to go to catch Ohio State. The gulf, you know, the difference between the two teams is too wide. I don't think that divide is that big. I mean, you can knock Brady Hoke for a lack of talent development. You can knock him for a lack of coaching acumen, which certainly we've seen as a defensive coordinator, Oregon's defense this year where he is now has just been abysmal. There's definitely, I think, some issues there in terms of like what he was doing in terms versus Harbaugh, who's one of the best at those things. But I think the talent, their recruiting was always good. The talent, you know, level, I think, has been very strong. They just haven't been getting the results. So getting a guy like Harbaugh, that's where you kind of course correct. And that's where, you know, I think you're right. I think that Jim Harbaugh said after that loss to Michigan State that they were going to bounce back from that just gut-wrenching, you know, Ohio State fans were laughing at it. It wound up costing them a berth in the playoff, effectively a Big Ten title due to tiebreakers. But just that kind of loss, just you don't see that very often. The Saints lost a game on like a missed PAT a couple weeks ago in the NFL. Like those kind of losses really stick with you. And Jim Harbaugh said that, you know, Michigan would bounce back from that loss better than anyone ever had. And he was right until the second half of that Ohio State game. And then they made a couple of mistakes. You know, then at that point, you're not going to be able to come back from that. And maybe that's when the psychological aspect gets in. I think that's where it gets interesting, right? If Michigan gets behind, say, you know, Paris Campbell is so close to breaking kick returns for touchdowns for Ohio State all season. If he finally gets one, Dontre Wilson comes back and he's kind of out there as the second guy, even though he struggled on punts, certainly. He was able to help the kick return unit. They break a touchdown. All of a sudden, Michigan's looking one score or two scores down. If they're 10, 14 points behind going into halftime, like, I don't know what buttons Jim Harbaugh will even be able to push, because just that monkey on their back is going to be screaming in their ears. So I think that's something to watch. Ohio State, I think, will be a little bit more equipped. I think the thing for Ohio State is just going to be able to see, can they get those wide receivers involved? Can, you know, JT, thankfully he won't be throwing into any wind or any rain or anything like that as far as the forecast shows. So I think if he's comfortable and confident, you know, they had some success running him last year against Michigan's defense. That defense is so good, especially against the run, but if JT can get going, they can get some momentum. Urban Meyer, so they're going to need all their weapons on offense, and I think that's right. If they get him involved, get Curtis Samuel, Dontre Wilson, Noah Brown, get all those guys as much touches as you can, diversify the attack, Ohio State will be in a good position to win, too.
Let's flip the script there for a moment, if we could. Luke Zimmerman joining us from LandGrantHolyLand.com for just a couple more minutes. Let's flip it over and give Michigan the ball now. If Wilton Spade is able to go, and we don't know, I would suspect not, but and maybe Jim Harbaugh is just being coy here, but he said he's progressing. He still has nothing to say, but he's progressing. In other words, he's kind of leaving it open that maybe Wilton Spade will play. I've heard of broken, what does he have? Is it a broken collarbone?
Yeah, I think that's allegedly. They haven't confirmed anything,
yeah.
So we don't know. But
if it is, that's a 6 to 8 week to 10 week recovery minimum. So he's not going to play. But maybe it isn't broken, and that's kind of why they're trying to keep this under wraps. But go and give Michigan the ball with Wilton Spade at quarterback, and then give them the ball with John O'Korn at quarterback, and tell me how that changes the matchup for Ohio State and how it impacts the outcome of this game.
Well, I think Spade looked more like, you know, Jim Harbaugh quarterback guru, the guy that turned Josh Johnson, a nobody athlete that was not recruited by any FBS schools at San Diego, little tiny San Diego University, into an NFL quarterback with the Buccaneers, the same guy that, you know, made Andrew Luck so good by and large, the same guy that turned Jake Ruddick from a project at Iowa into an NFL, you know, Detroit Lions practice squad quarterback. Wilton Spate has kind of shown some of those fingerprints this season. He looks like the guy that has been coached up and has, I think, won the respect and the confidence of his teammates. He's, you know, had some inconsistencies, but I think his stats by and large are great. Big arm, huge guy. If he's healthy or even, you know, able to play at 75% of his full ability, I think that's a big upgrade. John O'Korn, I think we saw last week against Indiana, even factoring in for the inclement weather, decision making wasn't as good. He's a little bit more mobile, certainly. I think that adds an element that Ohio State will have to prepare for. But he didn't seem as zoned in. And the pressure of an Ohio State game, I mean, there are these gamer type kids that can just really dial it up and, you know, play like their dare to be great moment is presenting itself and they run with it. But we didn't see that against Indiana. I'd be a little surprised if O'Korn is able to really dial it in, though he was, you know, as a freshman at Houston many, many years ago, was very good in a much, much different offense. He can throw the ball around, he can run a little bit, but I think the decision making is where that's gonna, I think, start to weigh against him. He had some guys open and he just didn't hit, and if that happens against Ohio State, we've already seen what the secondary can do. You're gonna have Malik Hooker, Marshawn Lattimore, Garian Conley, they're gonna be running this stuff back if you make a mistake. So I think Spate, you know, we saw him warm up last week against Indiana. It just seems like smoke and mirrors, some classic Bo Schembechler stuff, some
yeah.
Woody Hayes, you know, misdirection. He looked so just uncomfortable throwing the ball in warm-ups. I would be stunned if he played.
Yeah, I think you're right. And all it would take was one shot from somebody to knock him right back out of there again. And I can't imagine they'd want to do that to O'Korn and say, okay, now you got to go play midway through the first quarter after he takes his first hit and gets knocked out of the game. I think they're going to start with him. All right, you broke it down, I thought, very astutely and I think very fairly for writing for Land-Grant Holy Land and being an Ohio State guy. I think you did a really nice job of being fair about this whole thing. All that's left is to give me a final score. What happens?
I'll say Ohio State 21, Michigan 13. Might even be a 5-point or a 3-point game. Whoever has the ball last is going to be in position to win this one. And, you know, it might come down to one defensive stop for either team. So I'll say Ohio State by about 8, but, you know, you won't surprise me if it goes either way.
I think that's fair to say. Really great job. That's why we have you on, Luke, and we really appreciate your time, my friend. Keep up the great work at Land-Grant Holy Land, and thanks for the analysis.
Yeah, my pleasure. Happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Same to you, my friend. Thank you so much. That's going to do it, and happy Thanksgiving to everybody, although I will have one more chance to say that to you tomorrow, as we will be back with a live version of the Extravaganza tomorrow at 3 o'clock. We will be off on Turkey Day itself, obviously, but tomorrow, Paul Keels will join us to give another perspective on the Ohio State-Michigan game and much, much more, so stay where you are. We got Drive Time with Mike Miller coming up next, and I'll see you tomorrow at 3 o'clock, as promised, right here on The Ticket.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.